KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, 100 American cities and towns have formally called for a ceasefire in Gaza, ranging from Chicago, the biggest, to small towns in Vermont. And some have called for ending American military aid to Israel. Also, some include statements about fighting anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. John Nichols has our report. He's national affairs correspondent at The Nation. Also, the ideological roots of the January 6th insurrection, they go back decades before Trump entered politics, back to the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995. Jeffrey Toobin will explain January 6th is, in his words, the culmination of the principles and tactics of Timothy McVeigh. Jeff's new book is Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. It's being published in paperback next week. But first, in an election where many people are not excited about reelecting Joe Biden, they need other things to be enthusiastic about that will bring them to the polls in November. Democrats know that ballot initiatives protecting abortion rights is one of those things. Another is initiatives raising the minimum wage. So organizers are working right now to qualify minimum wage initiatives for the ballot in the crucial states of Arizona and Ohio, and they've already qualified one in Michigan. For that, we turn to Saru Jayaraman. She's the co-founder and president of the organization One Fair Wage and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. She appears regularly on media outlets like MSNBC and CNN and with Bill Maher on HBO. And she's the author of 5 books on low-wage worker issues. Most recently, One Fair Wage, Ending Subminimum Pay in America. Saru, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're told by pollsters that young people of color are not enthusiastic about voting for Joe Biden. What are the big issues for them?
So there was two huge polls done, national polls recently, one of youth voters and one of Latinx voters, and both of them had the rising cost of living and jobs with living wages as the absolute top issues. And it's so important to recognize that because sometimes it feels like you see Democrats focused on other issues, you know, but it's important to listen to what young people and people of color are saying is the top thing coming out of the pandemic. The rising cost of living never dissipated for them. It's an ongoing issue where people are genuinely struggling to pay rent, to pay food and pay bills. And of course, there are things to do to curb costs or maintain costs. But the number one thing we have to do is make sure people have the wages to be able to afford things in the marketplace.
And please remind us, what is the national minimum wage set by Congress right now?
It is a horrific $7.25 for most workers and an even more horrific $2.13 an hour for tipped restaurant workers.
Explain about this tipped wage thing. Where does this come from?
Unfortunately, it's a direct legacy of slavery. So prior to emancipation, waiters in the U.S. were mostly white men and they got actual wages, no tips. Tipping was not prevalent in the 1850s. But in 1853, they went on strike for higher wages. And of course, the restaurants didn't like that. And so they started looking for cheaper labor. So after emancipation, the restaurants hit upon the idea of hiring newly freed Black people. It wasn't actually just the restaurant industry's restaurants and a company called the Pullman Train Company. Pullman Train Company hiring Black men, restaurants hiring Black women, both telling Black workers, newly freed Black workers, we're not going to pay you. You're going to live on this wonderful thing called tips. And the Pullman car porters, as you probably know, organized the first Black union in the United States and won the right to one fair wage, a full minimum wage with tips on top, whereas the tipped workers in the restaurant industry, who are mostly Black women, never got that. And in fact, the National Restaurant Association was founded in response to the Pullman car porters organizing to ensure that the Black women, the women in the restaurant industry, never got a full wage, and they haven't to this day.
So we think of restaurants as the place where people live on tips, but they're not the only ones.
That's right. This horrific problem has spread. For the last 100 years, it's been mostly restaurants, but also nail salon, car wash, hair salon, parking attendants, the wheelchair attendants in the airport who push the wheelchairs, all of them can be paid a sub-minimum wage because they receive tips. But that has grown so dramatically post-pandemic. We're now seeing tipflation across the economy. We're seeing tipping in retail environments and kiosks in airports. We might not even see a human. And it's because as so many low-wage industries are struggling to find workers, they're looking to emulate the restaurant industry. Rather than raise wages to where workers really need them, they want the same boondoggle that the Restaurant Association has had for the last 100 years. Just make sure they get tips. And then legally, per federal law, if they get $30 a month in tips, they can be paid a sub-minimum wage, which is ridiculous. So as long as we allow the sub-minimum wage for the restaurant industry, every other industry is going to want to introduce tipping.
What we want to do about this, what you have dedicated the last couple of decades to, is eliminating sub-minimum wages for tipped workers by including them in the minimum wage laws. And that's something legislatures can do, and that's all something voters can also do through initiatives on the ballot. How have initiatives to raise the minimum wage done in previous elections?
There's been almost never a minimum wage initiative that has failed on the ballot.
There was one in 1992 or something like that.
There was another one that happened recently in Portland, Maine. But for the most part, statewide initiatives have almost never failed. Red states, blue states. And it's because most people in America agree. When you work a job, you should be paid a full livable minimum wage from your boss, enough to allow you to not have to be on public assistance, enough to allow you to feed your children and not work three jobs to survive. So it has passed, not just passed, but in Florida in 2020, more people voted for 15 than either Trump or Biden. It is so popular.
61% voted for a higher minimum wage in Florida in 2020.
That's right. And people always ask me, well, then how do we know it helps Democrats because Biden lost Florida? Well, in the case of Florida, the Florida Democratic Party specifically chose to not associate itself. It actually intentionally chose not to associate itself with the $15 minimum wage. Whereas in Ohio, in January, the Ohio Democratic Party already voted to endorse our initiative for November. Why? Because they know this is going to be a critical turnout mechanism for young people and people of color for Senator Sherrod Brown.
So the people we're talking about here, the political scientists called low propensity voters.
That's right.
What is your estimate of how many low propensity voters could be mobilized to vote for a higher minimum wage this November?
Well, nationally, if the president and vice president made this a top issue of their campaign, as they did in 2020, there are 32 million Americans who earn less than $15 an hour, who could potentially, in a dream world, get motivated because they see the top of the ticket running on the issue in a real way. What's a real way? It's not just saying, we're going to do this. It's saying, we pushed for this year. Help us get reelected to get the job done. We know we didn't finish the job. Help us get reelected to get the job done. So it could be up to 32 million Americans, but just in the four states where we have it on the ballot this fall, that's Ohio, Michigan, Arizona, key battleground states, and Massachusetts, that's 3.5 million workers who will get a raise. And of that, a very conservative estimate of 350,000 new voters who will turn out for Democrats if we have it on the ballot and folks in those states run on the issue.
And I think 350,000 is more than Biden's margin in Arizona and Georgia and Wisconsin.
Gosh, yes. Oh my gosh, yes. You're talking about 10 times the amount of votes needed in some of these really, you know, very close states. And as you said at the beginning, in states where, like Michigan and Arizona, young people are absolutely not motivated to vote this year for these candidates.
One Fair Wage is working to qualify minimum wage initiatives, you said, in crucial battleground states. Let's start with Arizona. I looked up the minimum wage in Arizona right now is $14.35. And what is the initiative proposing?
In Arizona, our initiative is actually to raise the wage to $18.
And where did this number 18 come from?
I mean, actually, Congressmember Ruben Gallego, who is running for Senate, said to us last year, 15 is not enough for Arizona. You have to do 18. So we tested it. And lo and behold, people in Arizona said, of course, we need to raise the wage to at least $18 an hour. And so we have 18 and ending the subminimum wage for tipped workers on the ballot in Arizona for this November.
Now, I just saw this morning that Republicans are planning to put a counter initiative on the ballot in Arizona. They're calling it the Tipped Worker Protection Act. And this would let businesses pay employees who work for tips 25% less than the minimum wage. Let's talk about the backlash.
So the Restaurant Association, as I mentioned, has been around since 1919. We call it the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association. Okay. Is the NRA that is honestly just as horrible and evil that people haven't heard about as the Rifle Association. Incredibly powerful, sadly, even with Democrats in many states, which is why we have to put things on the ballot, because we can't get it done, even with Democratic legislatures in many states. So they've been fighting for 100 years, claiming that they shouldn't have to pay their workers' wages because customers pay their workers' wages and tips. Well, in 2016, they actually hired the communications firm of the Trump-Pence campaign, Mercury PR, because they were so impressed with how Trump managed to basically brainwash or somehow shift the minds of working class voters to think that somehow he was in their best interests. So they hired the Trump-Pence communications firm, and they started a PAC called Save Our Tips, where they went around the country telling workers, your tips are going to go away if your wages go up, which is completely contrary to all the evidence of the last 100 years. For the states that have had a full minimum wage with tips on top, they actually have the same or higher tipping averages as the 43 states with a subminimum wage. So, for example, in the last quarter, California, which has had a same wage, one fair wage for 50 years, California was ranked as the highest tipping average state of any state in the U.S. Alaska has consistently been at the top of the list. So this idea that your tips are going to go away if your wages go up is something entirely fabricated by the Restaurant Association to get workers to fight their own wage increases. And that is the same framework of this ballot measure. They're trying to say if they put an initiative on the ballot that would reduce workers' wages, and they're going to claim, oh, that's better for you to get more tips, we're going to see as a test between, do people generally want to raise the minimum wage or people generally want to reduce the minimum wage based on the misinformation that somehow your tips will go away if your wages go up.
That's Arizona. You've qualified already a minimum wage initiative in Michigan. The recent history of minimum wage initiatives in Michigan is pretty interesting.
Yeah, 2018, we actually collected enough signatures, 400,000 signatures, to put one fair wage on the ballot. One fair wage meaning a $12 minimum wage and ending the subminimum wage for tipped workers, workers with disabilities, and youth on the ballot, November 2018 ballot. That was the year Governor Whitmer was up for election, and the Republicans knew they were going to lose the governorship and maybe even several of the legislature seats. So what they did is they announced to the press something, they understood something, John, that I sometimes struggle because some Democrats don't seem to understand it, but the Republicans understood how popular this initiative was. And they told the press, we are worried that this initiative will drive the wrong people to vote. Wrong people, meaning young people, people of color, women of color. We're going to take it off the ballot, make it the law, and then reverse it after the election. So the Republican-led legislature actually raised the wage from $3, which it is right now in Michigan, to $12 an hour, and then reversed it back down to $3 after the election. So in response, we filed a lawsuit, and any day now, the Michigan Supreme Court, which is now actually mostly Democrats, is going to rule on whether what they did back in 2018 was constitutional or not. We believe strongly they're going to rule it unconstitutional, which will make $12 and ending subminimum wages the law of the land. So Michigan is going to beat all these other states, New York, Illinois, Connecticut, in ending the subminimum wage for tipped workers. And it's going to become, I think, in the next month, not only the eighth state in the union to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers, not only the first state in 40 years to do so, but the first example in U.S. history of an attempt at Republican voter suppression leading to a minimum wage increase.
We are laughing. We are laughing with happiness.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us about your history in the organization, One Fair Wage. How did you get into this work?
Yeah, so I started after 9/11. I was recent graduate from law school, graduate school, and I was at working at an immigrant worker organizing center when I got a phone call from the union that was inside Windows on the World, which was the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower One in New York City. And they asked if I would start a relief center for the workers who had lost their jobs and the families of the victims. And what started as a relief center grew into a national organization fighting to raise wages and end subminimum wages across the country. We started with workers in New York, but everywhere we went and surveyed workers would say, it's my wages, it's my wages, it's my wages. When you understand that the restaurant industry is the lowest paying industry in the US and has been since emancipation, then it makes sense why workers keep talking about their wages as their top concern. And can I say one more thing? I just feel like sometimes in our world meaning the world of professionals or elites or academics, we aren't experiencing the struggle that most Americans are experiencing right now. And it has gotten extremely acute. Every state is experiencing an affordability crisis right now. The level of unhoused has dramatically increased in every major city in the United States. And people are leaving major cities because they just can't afford to live in major cities. People are leaving the restaurant industry because they can't afford to work in the restaurant industry. But, you know, just as an example of how severe it's gotten, I live in the Bay Area. You know, we know restaurant workers who work in San Francisco, but live an hour and a half east in Tracy or Stockton. They live in their car during their week in order to work in a restaurant in San Francisco because, you know, and these are working people who are facing home insecurity because they can't afford to live anywhere near where they work. And we're hearing those same stories across the country. We are experiencing an extreme affordability crisis right now. One half of the equation is certainly rent, looking at rent control, looking at other things we can do to manage people's costs. But we cannot ignore what people are saying. Their people are saying, I just need to be paid more. I need to be paid enough to cover the cost of living.
And you not only work to qualify these initiatives for the ballot and then to campaign for them, you have done a lot of work on what's the best way to organize. I understand three things I'd like you to explain. Paying your organizers instead of relying on volunteers.
Yes.
Peer-to-peer organizing and issue-based organizing.
Thank
it's
you.
A lot. It's a lot.
Yes. So yes, I'll start with issue-based voter engagement. I'm calling it IBVE. It's a new thing okay. coming up with. But okay. I gotta say, it just makes so much sense to every person I've talked to on the ground, which is that, as you started this conversation with, people are not that thrilled about the candidates. It's not like they're turning out in droves for the candidates this cycle. What is motivating people to vote or not vote and vote for X or Y are issues. It is issues that are most important, whether it's abortion or earning enough to feed your family. It is issues. And so we call it issue-based voter engagement because we find it is so much more effective to walk up to a young person and rather than asking them, hey, are you registered to vote? And they walk away from you saying, hey, do you want to sign my petition for $15 an hour? And they say, of course I want to sign. Where do I sign? And you say, I'm so sorry, you can't sign unless you're a registered voter. And then you stand right there and you register them to vote. It's more effective. It's faster and it's easier. And it's 20 times better if it's that person asking the question is a fellow low-wage worker. So in these states, we have hired hundreds, literally hundreds of service workers and other low-wage workers. We're paying them a livable wage of $25 an hour rather than hiring an outside firm. We find that doing it ourselves, we can do it for a third of the cost. They're charging $15 to $17 a signature. We're doing it for $4.50, paying a livable wage to service workers, in-state service workers. Those folks who are running that program, those hundreds of workers, are going to be the leaders of exactly what you described, a peer-to-peer voter program. Because here's what we know to be the three keys to our success. One, the issue. The issue is so crazy popular right now. Two, that it's led by workers themselves telling their fellow workers in a peer-to-peer format, hey, let's all go vote ourselves a raise. And while we're at the ballot voting ourselves a raise, we should think about these people who actually stood for our raise. And three, if it's issue-based and it's peer-to-peer. And then third, if you're actually registering new voters, if you're getting new people out through this mechanism, you're going to have a much bigger electorate that will turn out in November.
And there's one more thing that really helps. If the candidates run on this issue.
That's a no-brainer. I will say that we're seeing some candidates already understand that. You know, Senator Sherrod Brown has run on this issue. He actually, I don't know if people know, but he came into office on a minimum wage ballot in 2006.
I didn't know that.
That was the last time the minimum wage went up in Ohio, 2006. So he's running again on the next time it goes up, which is 2024. We're seeing, Congress members who've already endorsed it, like Greg Landsman in Cincinnati. We're seeing candidates already endorsing it. And I do think very soon you're going to see President Biden and Kamala Harris out on the road talking about this issue.
So if people want to know more about One Fair Wage, if they want to support the initiative campaigns underway right now in Ohio, Michigan, and Arizona, what can they do?
We would really appreciate it if they would go to onefairwage.org, onefairwage.org, and donate and or get involved. Let us know if you want to volunteer. Let us know if you want to get engaged in a particular way. You can email us at info@onefairwage.org, and we'd be happy to kind of immediately engage and get you involved.
Saru Jayaraman, she's the co-founder and president of the organization One Fair Wage, online at onefairwage.org. Saru, thank you for all your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. There's growing evidence of opposition to America's support for Israel in its war against the Palestinians in Gaza. 100 American cities and towns have formally called for a ceasefire in Gaza. For that story, we turn to John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books. Most recently, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-authored by Bernie Sanders. We reached him today at home in Madison. John, welcome back.
Good to be with you, my friend.
Well, we know about the votes for uncommitted in Democratic presidential primaries as a way people in several states have been organizing against the war. And we know about some members of Congress who've been calling on Joe Biden to try to stop the war. But I did not know how widespread support for a ceasefire was in city councils across the country until I read your report at thenation.com. Where are the big ones and what are some of the others?
Well, first off, I'm glad you're reading The Nation, John.
Okay.
You're right to frame it the way you did. Because I think there's been a great deal of attention to mass demonstrations against U.S. policy. There's been a reasonable amount of opposition or attention to the uncommitted or uninstructed votes around the country, which by the way, is continuing to grow. But to give you an example, as of now, probably about 500,000 people have voted uncommitted or uninstructed in primaries. If you add up the populations of the cities around the country that have endorsed a ceasefire and often gone even further to say that we should put restrictions on U.S. aid to Israel or even cut that aid altogether. If you add that all up, you're getting into the tens of millions. So this is a very, very big statement. Chicago is the biggest city that has done so far. Atlanta has done so. Minneapolis and St. Paul, which I know excites you very much.
Thank you.
Native Minnesotan. But San Francisco and lots of other big cities around the country, major cities. In Ohio, a whole bunch of them have done so. Toledo, Akron, others. And then you have, medium-sized cities around the country, quite a few of them, a lot of college towns. It's not overly surprising. My town of Madison, Wisconsin has one. My county of Dane County has one. Just last week, Milwaukee County in Wisconsin did it. And so those are the bigger ones. We also know that there's a lot of small towns that have done it, some rural places. 11 Vermont town meetings did so. And, you know, many other small and relatively rural towns across the country. It's in every region of the country, rural, suburban, urban. And it is, yes, certainly in some places like Dearborn and Hamtramck, where you have very large Muslim American populations. In towns in northern New Jersey, where you have some of the proportionally largest Palestinian American populations, that's not at all surprising. Of course, you'd see that. But what's significant is you're also seeing it in places that have extremely small Muslim populations and in some places that have very substantial Jewish population. Something big is being said from across America. People are saying that they want a ceasefire.
I want to look in particular at Sacramento as a kind of a typical mid-sized city that has passed the ceasefire resolution. What exactly does there say? Is it just give peace a chance?
No, it's much more detailed than that. And it's notable that it was brought together by a coalition of Jewish, Muslim, Christian, non-religious folks. But what they came up with was calling for an immediate and permanent bilateral ceasefire. And that's to end the violence. So first off, that's that baseline. You see that in almost all the resolutions. Then they called for an immediate unconditional release of Israeli hostages. They also called for an immediate unconditional release of all Palestinians held without charge or without trial in Israeli prisons. They called for something, and I'm going to quote it here, recognition that this conflict will not be solved militarily. Rather, it will be resolved diplomatically when wise, courageous, and visionary leaders on both sides replace the current leaders in charge today. And finally, they specifically call for action by the Biden administration to, you know, supercharge humanitarian aid to Gaza and work on the rebuilding of Gaza. And so it's that is, as you suggest, John, a relatively typical resolution. The only thing that you see in some other resolutions is more specific demands for an end to U.S. aid to Israel.
Now, Sacramento, I learned from your piece at thenation.com, has a mayor who is Jewish, Daryl Steinberg. What did he say about all this?
He was very active. He was very upfront. He introduced the resolution. And he did so at a press conference with a mix of rabbis and imams and cantors and activists. And, you know, I don't know the guy per se. I've covered him a little bit over the years, but I think it's safe to say he's a good politician, right? He had a real coalition there. And he acknowledged up front that not everybody was satisfied, that some people wanted more and some wanted less. And so it had this sort of dual purpose, one, to send a message to the White House, of course, that's first and foremost, and to Congress, but also to frankly bring people together on the ground in Sacramento and try and get them, you know, working together around some basic premises.
Well, now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. What's the word from St. Paul?
Well, St. Paul is very big for ceasefire. They cast a unanimous vote for a ceasefire. And that's not overly surprising because the Minneapolis-St. Paul area is an area very diverse, religiously, ethnically, a lot of immigrants there as well. And so it's a place where these issues are front and center. And what's notable is that the congresswoman from St. Paul, Betty McCollum, came out and said, this is a really big deal. This matters to me. I'm watching my community take this stand, and I value that because I'm standing up in Congress, and she's a supporter of ceasefire, and it's important to have this connection.
Minneapolis also passed a resolution, theirs, just across the Mississippi River, called not only for ceasefire and the release of hostages and prisoners. Minneapolis is one of the places that called for stopping U.S. military funding to Israel. The mayor, who is Jewish, Jacob Frey, vetoed it, apparently because of that last clause, but the city council overrode his veto. The vote was 9-3. So this was much more contentious than St. Paul. The mayor said he was concerned about rising anti-Semitism in Minneapolis and beyond. What's your response to that concern?
Well, I think rising anti-Semitism anywhere is a concern, and it's something that we should be very conscious of, as we should be of rising Islamophobia in this country. And many of these resolutions across the country have not merely spoken about the need for a ceasefire, but also addressed anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And so many communities have tried to sort that through. And what's important to understand is that in Minneapolis, while you did have this veto, you also had a lot of people in the Minneapolis Jewish community who were advocating for the ceasefire resolution. But at the heart of all this is an attempt, I think, by people at the local level, at the municipal level, to find that common ground, to build those coalitions, to try and come to a place where you can say, make a statement about foreign policy, but do so in a way that people can be relatively united on. Doesn't always work, but it does in a lot of places.
Great example of that from another city in Minnesota, smaller one, Moorhead, Minnesota, which is the one that's right across the state border from Fargo, North Dakota. They passed a resolution which included a statement that the city stands, quote, firmly against the rise of and all acts of violence and hate crimes perpetrated against our Jewish, Muslim, Palestinian, and Arab constituents here in Moorhead and around the United States, close quote. Moorhead, Minnesota, great example.
What's remarkable is, you know, how strong many of these Jewish-Muslim coalitions have become in many of these communities, where people really know each other and they're working together. And I think you saw a lot, I've seen a lot of that in Chicago as an example. And Chicago had a very contentious debate. And make no mistake, there were people who opposed the Chicago resolution. There were people from some communities that thought it didn't go far enough, some that thought it went way too far. But at the heart of it, there was a coalition of folks from Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, a whole bunch of Muslim American groups in the community. They came together, and when they ended up with a tie vote in the city council, the mayor, the new mayor, a great progressive in that city, Brandon Johnson, cast the tie-breaking vote in favor of CSTAR.
Well, we've been talking here about cities and towns. Now, one state legislature, the first, has passed the ceasefire resolution, Hawaii. The vote there was 24-1 in the state Senate. What do you know about Hawaii politics?
Hawaii has a deep consciousness. There's a lot of people in Hawaii with a deep consciousness of what happens to indigenous peoples, what happens to when you have outside forces playing, you know, on all sides of a political fight. And it's very interesting that in Hawaii, you have had two major signs of some of the higher level of support for ceasefire in the United States. In their Democratic primary, almost 30% of people voted for uncommitted. And I think 7 delegates from Hawaii will go to the Democratic National Convention as uncommitted because of a Gaza-related campaign there. And now you've had the state Senate there cast this overwhelming vote for ceasefire. And I think that it's a reminder, as you look around the country, you find places that are supportive of a ceasefire that might surprise you, might not be in your first blush, might not be the place you thought would be strong on that issue. But because of history, as well as contemporary activism, they are. And I'll remind you, as we look on the global stage, right, there's some people who are surprised that Ireland is so profoundly committed to ceasefire in Gaza and to resolving the crisis there. And then you look back at Ireland's history and you know, things start to come into perspective.
Great example. The big question is, how much have these municipal ceasefire resolutions affected members of Congress? How many members of the House at this point have called for a ceasefire?
Well, there's a lot that have called for a ceasefire. I'll be honest with you. I think that, you know, there is a core group that called before a lot of the municipal resolutions started. And so give them respect for stepping up early, people like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. But yes, the numbers have grown. There's now about 80 in the House. The group Win Without War has been keeping a good calculation of, or keeping a good list. And there's a number of senators that have stood up now as well.
I think it's 8 senators have called on Biden to offer Israel an ultimatum, either expand aid to Gaza or lose U.S. military assistance. They're led by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Hawaii's Mazie Hirono, Minnesota's Tina Smith, Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, Jeff Merkley of Oregon. Not very many senators.
No. And when they actually had a chance to vote on it, right, which is a little different than writing a letter, right, when you actually voted on it, Sanders had an amendment he was trying to move on this. And I think he got, essentially, there were two other people who voted with him. And that was Jeff Merkley, who you mentioned, and then Senator Peter Welch, from also from Vermont. And so, look, there's a lot of ground that has to be made up in Congress. What's really notable is, and one of the reasons I wrote about this, is that as you look around the country, what you see is that this ceasefire movement is big and it's growing, and there's tremendous level of support for it. When you get up to Capitol Hill, you still see an awfully lot of leaders in Congress, a lot of powerful players in Congress who just refuse to sign on and or refuse even to listen at times. And this is one of the challenges. And I think that's why the municipal ceasefire movement kind of keeps going. And one of the interesting things that they've done is that we're now seeing resolutions in some places which specifically address their member of Congress and say, we would like to see our member of Congress by name step up on this issue.
It's big and it's growing. John Nichols wrote about city councils passing ceasefire resolutions for thenation.com. John, thanks for talking with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, John.
Same old story, back again.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. It's been 28 years since the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995, carried out by Timothy McVeigh, killed 168 people, including 15 children in the daycare center. There's a direct link between that event and the insurrection of January 6th. That's what Jeffrey Toobin argues in his new book, Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. Toobin is the author of many bestsellers, including The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. We talked about it here. We reached him today in Manhattan. Jeff Toobin, welcome back.
Hi, John.
Well, let me start by listing the ways the Oklahoma City bombing was different from the January 6th events. It was not an attempt to overturn a presidential election. It was not an attack on the Capitol building or on Congress. Was not instigated by a defeated presidential candidate, and it was not a mass event involving thousands of people fighting the police for hours. Nevertheless, you do make a convincing case about the direct links that make January 6th, in your words, the culmination of the principles and tactics of Timothy McVeigh. Tell us about those links.
Well, the links are really ideological. McVeigh was motivated above all by an obsession with gun rights and what he called the Second Amendment, his understanding of the Second Amendment. And if you look at right-wing violence in subsequent years, including January 6, 2021, the fixation on gun rights is a constant among them all, as is the belief that violence is an appropriate way to achieve political change. And the third thing that is a link, and one that was, to be honest, quite, you know, somewhat of a surprise to me, was a persistent desire to identify with the American Revolution, that McVeigh had memorized the Declaration of Independence, not just the famous part at the beginning, but the parts where Thomas Jefferson outlined his grievances against the King of England. And if you look at January 6th in particular, you see this continuing attempted association between rebellion against an evil federal government with rebellion against an evil kingdom from across the Atlantic. So those are just three of the examples of the ideological links between McVeigh and the January 6th people.
A key part of your book, Homegrown, is your revelations about the trial and what was left out or what was misleading in the trial. It portrayed Timothy McVeigh as a lone wolf, and you show that, in fact, he wanted to start a movement, which today seems extremely important. Why was that left out of the prosecution case, and who made that decision?
Well, one of the protagonists of Homegrown is Merrick Garland, who at the time was a senior but not very top Justice Department official, who was assigned supervision of the Oklahoma City bombing case. One of the odd, interesting facts that I learned is that he actually wanted to try the case, but his boss wouldn't let him because she wanted him to take charge of the Unabomber investigation, which was floundering at the time, well before the arrest of Ted Kaczynski. But Garland had a particular aversion to what was going on in the O.J. Simpson criminal case, which was unfolding at precisely the time of the Oklahoma City bombing. And he wanted the McVeigh prosecution to be very different. He wanted it to be very much lower profile, very much focused on the evidence. He didn't want any celebrity worship involved. And he was the person who really urged the prosecutors to keep the case very narrowly tailored to the precise evidence against McVeigh and Terry Nichols, his co-defendant. I don't really fault Garland for that. You know, that given what his obligation was at that time, I think that was an understandable decision. However, I do think that has informed his extreme reluctance as attorney general to talk about the larger threats involved.
So Merrick Garland wanted to keep this as narrow as possible, but there was another person who wanted to look at the big picture.
And that was Bill Clinton. I was fortunate to interview President Clinton for this book. And before I interviewed him, I had interviewed people who had seen him in the Oval Office on April 19th, 1995. You know, in private before he made any public statement about the bombing. And one thing that really shocked me was that at a time when a lot of people, including many people in public, were assuming that the bombing was the product of Islamic radicalism, Clinton was saying privately, no, 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 I know who did this. It was the militias. And so when I interviewed Clinton, I said, how did you know? And he said, I knew them from Arkansas, and he wow. went through chapter and verse about his 12 years as governor and how many times he dealt with violent right-wing extremism from Arkansas-based extremists. And it was completely fascinating to me. And I then checked out everything he said, and it did check out as true. And that to me was, you know, just an extremely important signal that Timothy McVeigh did not come out of nowhere. He was part of a movement, and that movement predated the Oklahoma City bombing, and it has postdated the Oklahoma City bombing.
Who was Timothy McVeigh before the Oklahoma City bombings? You show he had a kind of unhappy childhood, but lots of people have had unhappy childhoods.
Well, that's the thing about McVeigh is that, you know, you can point to various aspects of his background. He came from outside Buffalo, where his father worked for 30 years at a GM plant. His grandfather worked at the same GM plant for 30 years, but that plant was shrinking almost to insignificance when McVeigh was growing up. So he grew up with, you know, economic uncertainty and dislocation. He joined the Army. He was a very good soldier, but he washed out of Green Beret School, where he wanted to, you know, make it to Special Forces, and he didn't. His parents had a rancorous divorce. He was not successful with women. All of these factors were, I think, part of what led him to be the terrorist he turned out to be. But they are also true of millions of other people. He was not unique in any of these ways. But some switch flipped, and he turned into someone whose grievances, while fairly ordinary, turned violent, which was not ordinary.
And you say that his ideology should not be described as anti-government. Why is that?
Well, the Rosetta Stone of his ideology was a novel called The Turner Diaries. And he read it as a teenager and read it over and over again. And what that novel portrays is a federal government that has been taken over by Blacks and Jews. And the first thing they do is pass a law called the Cohen Act, which mandates the removal of all private firearms from individual hands. And as a result, Earl Turner, the protagonist and narrator of the book, sets off a truck bomb by the FBI building in Washington, which kills hundreds of people. McVeigh very intentionally used the Turner Diaries as a model for the Oklahoma City bombing. And that grievance, especially about gun rights, was at the center of his belief. September 14th, 1994 was the day that Bill Clinton signed the assault weapons ban. And that was the triggering, intentionally use that word, factor for McVeigh and Nichols to begin final preparations of building the bomb. Gun rights were central to his beliefs.
And McVeigh saw his attack on the federal building in Oklahoma City also as a response to the FBI attack on the Branch Davidian compound outside Waco, Texas.
On April 19th, 1993, the FBI ended a standoff with this religious extremist compound in outside Waco. The Branch Davidians was the group. David Koresh was the leader. The FBI fired tear gas in. To this day, there is some dispute over what exactly happened at that point, whether the people inside triggered the conflagration. In any case, there was a horrible fire. 76 people were killed. And McVeigh thought that was a perfect symbol of the evil of Bill Clinton's federal government. And that's why he did the bombing precisely 2 years later in Oklahoma City.
And Waco today has not been forgotten.
Right. Donald Trump gave the first big rally of his 2024 campaign at a rally outside Waco. You know, Waco has become a battle cry of the people who believe the federal government, including the FBI, are fundamentally evil. And Trump, it was very clearly associating himself with that movement by holding the rally there, of all places.
You said that Timothy McVeigh was obsessed with guns and gun rights and with 1776. I learned from your book there was a bunch of other things he was mad about: immigrants, women, what had happened to the economy of Buffalo. Let's talk about those things.
You know, it's all of a package, and it's all very familiar. It's racial resentment against affirmative action. McVeigh thought that he didn't get promotions in the army and he didn't get a job in Buffalo because Black people had gotten there ahead of him. He was appalled at the prospect of women in the military. He thought they weren't up to it. He was also rejected by women in terms of his romantic life, and I think today would be described as an incel, involuntary celibate. So if you look at his ideological profile, it's so similar to Dylann Roof, who attacked the church in South Carolina, the terrorists who attacked the Walmart in El Paso, the grocery store in Buffalo. This is a worldview that is very familiar to us, sadly, and it's no coincidence that they are all ideologically aligned.
And you say for Timothy McVeigh, there was one media source above all that got him interested in all of these issues.
He was a Ditto head. He was a Rush Limbaugh fan. And one of the amazing aspects of this story was McVeigh had this incredible ability to take long, long drives across the country. He would go from Buffalo to Michigan, where Terry Nichols lived, to Arizona, where his friend Michael Fortier lived, to Waco, where he watched some of the siege, to his sister in Florida. He drove all over the country And he always had 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh. And if you look at the way he expressed himself in letters during this period, it was right out of the Limbaugh phrase book.
And I also learned from your book that McVeigh wanted the Oklahoma City bombing to set off a broad rebellion that would overthrow the federal government. And you quote him saying, "I believe there is an army out there ready to rise up, but I haven't found it," close quote. What's changed since 1995 to bring this army together?
Well, this to me was the central difference. We've talked about the similarities, but the difference between McVeigh of 1995 and the extremists of today. McVeigh had no mechanism, no ability to find other extremists. He'd go to gun shows. He tried to talk to people. He sold the Turner Diaries. It wasn't efficient. He didn't have the personality for it. But what's different is the internet and social media. You know, what prompted me to write this book, John, which got me interested, I had covered the McVeigh and Nichols trials back in 1997, so it had always been rattling around my head. But in October of 2020, that was when the FBI arrested the plotters to kidnap Governor Whitmer of Michigan. And I saw that they were affiliated with the Michigan militia, which was the same group that Terry Nichols, the co-defendant, had been affiliated with in Michigan. And I said, I know these people. I know what they believe. And that was the first of the connective tissues that I discovered between McVeigh and the current day.
The internet is one huge change since then. There's one other one, which was September 11th, which of course made it seem like it was Islamic extremists that were the biggest threat to the United States, not domestic terrorists.
What happened after 9/11, and look, given the magnitude of 9/11, it's not surprising that it had a major impact on American life, but both by accident and very much by design, people began to see terrorism as exclusively an Islamic phenomenon. And that of course, was never true. But there was certainly an effort on the right to distract people from the persistence and danger of right-wing terrorism by trying to argue that it was all Islamic. And the epilogue to Homegrown really spells out how many Republicans tried to pretend that right-wing terrorism didn't exist, and at the same time showing that it was very much still present in American life.
Well, bringing it up to the present, there have been a lot of complaints about Merrick Garland for the last couple of years that he's been too slow and too timid in pursuing the January 6th crimes, But now we've seen that his prosecutors have convicted the leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers on the charge of seditious conspiracy, a really serious charge. That is big.
It is big. And I want to be very clear about what I think about Merrick Garland. I think the substance of what he has done has been very impressive. You know, they've prosecuted almost 1,000 people. Including some, as you point out, on various serious charges. I'm a former federal prosecutor myself. I know that complex cases take a long time to put together. So I'm not prepared to criticize Merrick Garland for failing to prosecute the higher-ups in the January 6th conspiracy. Let's see what happens. That investigation is very much ongoing. The nature of my criticism is that Garland has not used the bully pulpit of Attorney General to talk about the threats that right-wing extremism presents. You know, he is someone who believes that the Justice Department should basically only talk in a courtroom, and I don't think that's correct. I think it is important to point out the magnitude of the threat the country faces from the right. He has alluded to it. Chris Wray, the director of the FBI, has alluded to it, but this is a real threat, and I think it's incumbent upon the Attorney General to keep talking about it as well as keep prosecuting it in the courtrooms.
And finally, one of the most impressive things about your book, Homegrown, is the huge amount of information you learned about Timothy McVeigh. much, much more than was ever revealed in the trial. How were you able to do this?
Well, this was a very odd thing that happened. Stephen Jones, who was McVeigh's lead lawyer, donated every scrap of paper, 635 boxes, from his defense of McVeigh to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. He took a big tax deduction. All of that material included all of his interviews with McVeigh and all of his legal strategy memos. Now, I don't think you have to be a lawyer to have some questions about whether that is an appropriate thing to do because of client confidences, because of the attorney-client privilege, which it is clear outlasts the death of the client. McVeigh was executed in 2001. And frankly, I do have some misgivings about whether it was appropriate for Jones to do that. However, as a journalist, I was thrilled to take advantage of that decision. And so there was this enormous amount of material, which also included all the information that had been turned over by the federal government in discovery. So I had all the FBI interviews. It is a rich, rich trove of information. And that was a principal source for me in Homegrown.
The story of Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995 is not just a glimpse of the past, it's a warning about the future. Jeffrey Toobin's new book is Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. Jeff, thanks for this book, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, John.
Jeffrey Toobin's book on Timothy McVeigh will be out in paperback April 9th. We spoke with him in May 2023. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.